line and you've got to keep it going. Nephew. He listened now in disbelief as his mother recounted his activities of the past week, and it was as if she was speaking of someone else. She told of the math test, for which he had received a B+, the English composition that Mr. Parker had asked him to read aloud to the class, bringing him both embarrassment and triumph. She told her what he ate, what he wore, the new shoes he had bought, all the trivialities of his life, with no mention of the things that mattered, Amy, or the poetry he wrote late at night in his room, his longings, his hopes. He's such a good boy. I feel bad about what's happened. Now, Louise, you're in a black mood tonight. Please cheer up a little.
I know. I know. We have so much to be thankful for. I have so much. David and Adam and, of course, you, dear Martha.
A noise caught Adam's attention. His father's footsteps. He removed the receiver from his ear, but realized he couldn't simply hang up. The click would echo like an explosion across the wires. The footsteps grew closer as his father came up the stairs. Adam excruciatingly watched his own hand, with the receiver in it, approach the instrument. He put the receiver in the cradle, softly, gently, with tenderness, and then whirled as his father walked into the den. Thankfully, his father was reading one of his insurance contracts as he walked along, and did not notice Adam standing guiltily at the telephone. But more than that, he did not see the terrible look of astonishment that Adam knew was shining in his eyes.
"They've been lying to me," he thought with horror. "All my life, they've been lying to me."
And so, for the first time, you had actual and direct evidence that there was something wrong, that there was something askew. 5-second interval. Do you feel well?
I'm not sure. I feel dizzy.
An anxiety reaction, nothing more. Oh, the dizziness is real, I grant you, but the cause is anxiety. A sudden, sharp memory.
May I rest? I'm tired now.
Are you retreating?
No, really, but I'm dizzy and tired and my stomach feels queasy. I feel as though I've been here in this room forever.
I agree it has been a long session, the longest thus far. More than an hour. Almost two. Let us suspend, then.
Thank you.
End tape OZK-006.
There are three of them. They are huddled around a table in the corner near the jukebox, eating popcorn. They toss the popcorn in the air and catch it in their mouths as if they're on stage and expect people to applaud. The jukebox is old and decrepit. No neon lights, no fancy touches. I wonder if it has the farmer in the dell, but that's impossible, of course. The farmer in the dell is not a jukebox kind of song. I'm worried about the three guys eating popcorn. They glance my way once in a while, and then whisper among themselves. This is a small restaurant, a lunchroom, really, and we are the only occupants. The counterman is a small, thin fellow with a toothpick sticking out of his mouth, and he is always on the telephone. No sooner does he hang up the phone, but it rings again and the toothpick dances in his teeth as he talks. The clam chowder is hot. It burns the roof of my mouth, and I take a gulp of water and then chew the small soda crackers. The chowder soothes my stomach and dissolves the rock there. I look at the three guys, and I am glad that my bicycle is at the police station. When I arrived in Carver a few minutes ago, the first building I saw on Main Street was a combination post office, police station, and fire department. I went inside and asked the policeman at the desk if I could leave my bike for safekeeping while I found a place to eat. He was reading a newspaper and didn't even look up.
"Sure, kid," he said. "We aim to please."
The weird thing is that he didn't look at me at all. I mean, I could have had two heads or been carrying a rifle or anything, and he wouldn't have cared. I didn't leave my father's package with the bike. I untied the belt that held it to the bike and took it outside with me.
On the street, I noticed that Carver is such a small town that it doesn't even have parking meters. I spotted the lunchroom. The faded sign said, Eats. That's all. I like that kind of thing. Amy does, too. Nothing phony or fancy about it. The counterman ladled out the clam chowder while talking on the telephone. The telephone was cradled between his chin and shoulder. I figured the chowder would be good for sustenance on my journey, all that milk and stuff. The man dropped a large chunk of butter into the chowder and grimaced at me. I realized the grimace was actually a smile. The butter immediately began to melt. I didn't particularly like butter melting in my clam chowder, but he seemed to think he was doing me a favor, so I smiled and said, Thanks. He waved me away, still talking on the telephone, his voice so low I couldn't hear what he was saying. Something hits my arm as I eat, and I look down at the floor and see where the piece of popcorn has landed. Another piece arrives, barely missing the chowder, like in school when the wise guys threw spitballs. I don't look at the troublemakers, and I concentrate on my chowder. I blow on the chowder to cool it off. I remove my father's package from the other chair at the table and put it on my lap for safekeeping. I hear the popcorn guys giggle. You can tell them a mile away, the wise guys. I recognize them as soon as I stepped into the place. They are everywhere in the world, in schools and offices, in theaters and factories, in stores and hospitals. Now one of them gets up and walks toward me. He's about 16 or 17, and he has freckles and straight white teeth, and he looks like a million other kids his age except for that subtle difference that marks him for what he is. Never saw you around here before, kid, he says, stopping at my table, looming above me. I take a spoonful of the chowder. It's getting cooler, and I can swallow it without burning my throat. I'm just passing through, I say. Where you from? He asks. Monument. In Massachusetts. And where are you going? He is asking questions, but it's obvious that he is not interested in the answers. The questions are only a prelude to what he really wants. Trouble. Rutterburg? Rutterburg, Vermont. You hitching? No, I've got my bike. All the time I'm talking, I'm gulping down the chowder and chewing the clams and the crackers. Well, where's your bike? He walks to the window and looks out into the street. He looks back at his friends who are still at the table, tossing popcorn into their mouths and missing most of the time. I don't see no bike. It's at the police station, I say. I left it there for safekeeping. I realize immediately I have made a mistake by saying that. He had been walking away from the window, toward my table, and now he stops in mid-motion. He shakes his head, as if tremendously puzzled. He looks again at his friends. The police station? He asks in mock amazement. To keep his bike safe? I know what is coming. And it comes. I guess he doesn't trust us, he says, shaking his head, his voice phonily sorrowful. I guess this boy from Massachusetts don't trust the people in Carver, New Hampshire. I swallow the last of the chowder and cram my mouth with crackers. My hand trembles as I put the spoon down. I should have taken my pills this morning. I look at the counter, and the man is still on the telephone, the toothpick still in his teeth. The wise guy hovers over me. Is that the real reason you left your bike with the cops? Because you don't trust us? Look, I say, pushing away the bowl of chowder. I'm on my way to Rutterburg, and the bike is my only means of transportation. If somebody takes it, I'm dead. Can't you hitch? He asks. Hell, me and Dobie and Lewis, we hitched all the way to Montpelier the other day. Right, fellas? Glancing over his shoulder at them. Right, Whipper, one of them calls. I wipe my lips with the napkin and pick up my father's package from my lap. My hands are shaking slightly. What's that? Whipper asks. What's what? I asked back, my voice quivering. That package there, in your hands, he says, impatient. You're carrying it like it's a bomb or something. So careful. Have you got a bomb there? You planning to blow up Carver, New Hampshire? No, I say, it's a present, a gift, from my father. He's in Rutherburg, Vermont, and I'm bringing it to him. I stand up, pushing the chair away. The legs of the chair scrape the floor. The other fellows stand up, too. My heart races. I am such a coward. The counterman is still on the telephone, turned sideways from us. I'd like to know what's in that package, Whipper says, his voice low and deadly. We face each other. I realize now that he is shorter than I am, but heavier. His shoulders are wide. There's a scar on his forehead above his right eye. His eyes are small, embedded in his face. My heart is beating dangerously, and I feel the blood rushing to my face. Yes, sir, that package must really be something, he says. But he isn't looking at the package. He is looking at me. Our eyes are locked. I clutch the package. I think of my father, and I stand there, not moving. My heart is threatening to explode in my chest, and my lungs scream with pain. I realize that I have been holding my breath, but I look him in the eye. The package is for my father, and nobody, nobody is going to take it away from me or prevent me from bringing it to him. I stand there like a tree. I will not bend. I will not give him the package. I am the package. Finally, he takes his eyes away from mine and steps back, a pitying look on his face. Shit on your old package, he says, shaking his head. Hey, what's going on there? The counterman calls. Finally. He still hasn't hung up the telephone. It's still cradled on his shoulder, but at least he's become aware of what's going on in his lunchroom. Oh, nothing, Luke, Whipper says, and fades from my sight, going back to his cohorts at the table. I exhale. Then I draw sweet air into my lungs. The air caresses them. My heart is still pounding dangerously, but the beats are beginning to soften. I grab my father's package, and I get out of there, quick, without looking right or left.
Tape OZK-007-0215, date deleted, TA. What's the matter? How can I be of assistance? 5-second interval. What's wrong? Evidently, you're upset. But tell me. 10-second interval. I don't want to seem unnecessarily harsh, but it would assist the situation if you spoke, if you explained. 5-second interval. My boy, it's 2:15 in the morning. I told you at the beginning I would be available to you at any time of day or night. And that's true. That's why I'm here. But you must also do your part. You must assist me. 10-second interval. Tell me, what's wrong? Evidently there is something wrong. What is it? I'm here to help. 6-second interval.
What comes next?
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
Explain, please.
The blanks. All the blanks. If you know what they are, fill them in for me.
He had awakened from sleep as if shot out of a cannon. Out of the everywhere, into the here and now. The room, the bed, the cold moonlight chilling the room. He was in the bed and aware of the cold sheets, but he was also suspended, isolated, inhabitant of an unknown land, an unknown world, and he himself unidentified. Caught and suspended in time. Who am I? I am Adam Farmer. But who am I?
I am Adam Farmer. But Adam Farmer was only a name. Words. A lesson he had learned here in the cold room and in that other room with the questions and answers. Who is Adam Farmer? He didn't know. His name might as well have been Kitchen Chair or Cellar Steps. Adam Farmer was nothing. The void yawned ahead of him and behind him, with no constant to guide himself by. Who am I? Adam Farmer. Two words, that's all. He was oozing perspiration, floating in his own body fluids, the pajamas soaked with sweat. Lie still. Lie still, lie still, and the panic will pass. That's what they told him, and sometimes the panic passed. But only with a pill, and some desperate nights, with a shot, the needle bringing peace at last. But now, at this moment, he was a raw wound, bleeding panic, the bedsheet a shroud, crazy. He tried to send his mind in different directions, past and future, but it didn't work. Faces passed by as if on a whirling merry-go-round, but they vanished before he could focus on them, pin them down, bring them into sharp portrayal. There was a strange sound in the room, and he listened, mouth agape, bones chilled. His own sounds, a moan issuing from his body. He tried to clutch at something in the dark, seeking something to hold on to, but there was nothing. He was surrounded by nothingness, here in the bed and here in his life. What life? Whose life?
We have filled in many blanks. Or don't you remember?
Not enough. Not enough.
These things can't be rushed. You were told that in the beginning. You must relax. You must ride out these panics. I am as much in a hurry as you to fill the blanks, but it's a time-consuming thing.
Why can't I remember? Why can I remember just so much, a little at a time?
Do you suppose it's because you really don't want to remember?
But I do. I do.
Perhaps one part of you wants to remember and another part doesn't.
But why?
Who knows?
Is it because there's something so terrible there that one part of me doesn't want to know about it?
That's what we must learn. Slowly and patiently. 10-second interval. It's late. Do you wish something to make you sleep? To ease, as you call it, the panic?
I'm tired of pills and needles.
Perhaps that's a good sign.
Why do you have so many perhapses and maybes and we'll sees? Can't you help me?
This is the best way I can help you.
It isn't enough.
Should we review, then? Review all you have remembered? All the blanks that have been filled?
No. I don't care about the blanks that are filled in. It's the ones that are still blanks that I want to talk about. What am I doing here? How long have I been here? I hate this place. The people here hate me, too.
Why should they hate you?
They know I'm not like them. That's why they hate me.
Tell me, how do you know they hate you?
I know. I know.
But how? 5-second interval.
I'm tired now.
Is the panic gone?
Yes. I think I can sleep now. Without the pills.
You may have one if you wish.
Well, maybe one.
Fine. Fine. We shall meet again in only a few hours.
Good. I'm really sleepy.
Sleep well, sleep well.
Thank you.
End tape OZK007.
I am about to get on my bike and leave the town of Carver forever when I spot the telephone booth down the street. At last. I lash my father's package to the basket and push the bike toward the booth. An old lady looks at me as I go by, and she smiles at the toque on my head. She has a hat on her head, too. It looks like a red flower pot, complete with flowers. I smile at her. I am happy, suddenly. I will survive Carver. And next comes Fleming, and then Hooksett and Belton Falls. There are long distances between Fleming and Hooksett, and then between Hooksett and Belton Falls, but this doesn't discourage me. I feel strong and resolute. I defeated the troublemakers in the lunchroom, and I will defeat anyone else. But most of all, I am about to talk to Amy, to hear her voice again. I fumble for change and insert the coin, and the mail operator comes on the line. I give him the number and go through all the rest of the routine, and then the line is ringing. Ringing. Please be home, Amy. Please be home.
Hello? Hello?
The voice is harsh and impatient. Mr. Hertz's headline voice. Hello, may I speak to Amy?
Who is this?
Adam. Adam Farmer, I'd like to speak to Amy, please.
Amy who? There's no Amy here.
The voice is not the headline voice of Mr. Hertz after all. This is not her father. I see the three fellows from the lunchroom on the street. They are drifting in my direction. Two of them are walking side by side, slowly and leisurely, but something threatening in their pace. The other one, Whipper, walks alone, ahead of them. I feel trapped in the booth. The bike is vulnerable, untied and unbolted outside the booth, and I have a wrong number.
Listen, the man on the phone begins. I've got the bug, and I've been hacking away all day, and I finally doze off, and then the phone rings.
I'm sorry, I say, and I slam down the phone. I don't like to hang up on people, but the troublemakers are drifting closer, and I have to get out of there. I'm sorry, Amy. I can't even get a telephone number right. I don't deserve you. The boys are coming closer, slowly, but surely and menacingly, and I swing open the door of the booth and grab the bike. I run along beside the bike and then leap upon it. My feet engage the pedals and I pump away. I shoot through a red light and a car blows its horn at me, but I am away, leaving Carver behind, leaving the troublemakers behind. But I don't feel brave anymore, and my cheeks are wet, even though it isn't raining.
Tape OZK008-0930, date deleted, TA.
The Gray Man.
One moment, please. Let me sit first.
The Gray Man.
You look positively excited. I have never seen you in such a state. This is good.
The Gray Man.
And who is this Gray Man?
I'm not sure. But he's important. It happened last night after I returned to my room. They gave me a pill. And I lay there, letting myself drift, thinking of all the blank spots that have been filled in. Amy, the clues. And suddenly I remembered him.
And you call this person the Gray Man?
Yes, but only in my mind. That's what I always called him, the Gray Man.
And why was that?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think it's important. He's important.
In what way?
I can't tell yet. I'm not certain. But I think of him, what he looked like, and I know he's important. A real clue. I can feel it in my bones.
Tell me more. 3-second interval.
I wish I could, but I can't.
Can't or won't?
Can't, won't. Don't you think I want to remember, that I want to know? All I know right now is that there was a man in the past, someone I referred to as the Gray Man, and I have a feeling he was important. In all that blackness, he's the only clue I've got.
Then rest easy. Relax. Let it come. Perhaps a pill.
No. No pill. No shot either.
Whatever you wish. 10-second interval. Anything?
Nothing.
Don't force. Don't force. Let the thoughts come. Try to think of this Gray Man, what he looked like, What his name was? What he did? Where did you see him most of the time? Was he a friend, a relative, an uncle, perhaps?
Shut up! Stop!
10-second interval.
He's gone. I had him. I had him right on the brink. I almost remembered, and now he's gone.
5-second interval. He'll return. The important thing is that you made contact. Remember earlier how the clue of the dog led to the clue of Amy Hertz and that phone call? And the phone call led to the birth certificate?
I don't want to talk about all that. I want to go back to my room.
There's no hurry.
I prefer to go back.
Let's talk of something else.
I want to go to my room.
10-second interval. For instance, Paul Del Monte.
Is he the gray man?
Do you think he is?
I don't know. You asked me about him before, at the beginning, and I said I didn't want to talk about him. But I was bluffing. I didn't know who he was.
Do you know who he is now?
No.
Who do you think he is?
I want to go back. I'm not going to say another word.
5-second interval. As you wish. Let us suspend. End tape OZK-008.
I am a mile or so outside of Carver, on a narrow road in the country. No houses anywhere. Once in a while a car passes, uncomfortably close on the narrow roadway. The road is paved, but it's pockmarked with ruts and holes. The road drops off into a ditch about 4 feet deep, and there is no sandy shoulder. I have no rearview mirror, and I try to maintain a straight course as I pedal along. I'm glad to be leaving Carver behind, and glad for the bike, and glad for the sun shining, and glad to be safely away from the wise guys, the troublemakers. I'm only sad about Amy, but I'll call her the next time I see a phone booth, before I eat or stash my bike or anything else. She is more important to me than food. Than the bike, even. I hear a car coming. The cars usually don't speed on this road, because it's not built for speed, and there is barely room for two cars to pass each other. But this car that's approaching is going fast. I can tell by the motor. The motor roars and whines. The motor grows louder. I grip the handlebars tightly, holding on. I'm afraid that the car will cause a rush of wind that will suck me off the road as it passes. The car approaches, the sound of the motor gathering in volume, filling the air. It soars past me at great speed, so close that it almost brushes my elbow. I'm thrown off balance and lose speed, and the bike almost tips over as the front wheel wobbles. The car recedes ahead of me, and I want to raise my fist and hurl an insult at the driver. But I look up and see a familiar face in the rear window of the car. One of the troublemakers at the lunchroom. I pedal furiously now, not because I want to catch up with them, but because this road is deserted and I want to reach a better road or highway as soon as possible. I feel more vulnerable than ever. There are no houses in sight. Most of the cars use the interstate that runs parallel to this old road. I keep pedaling. There's a curve ahead. Maybe there'll be a house or a new road or something around the curve. I hear the car again. That unmistakable motor. The car is coming back. The car is rounding the curve, heading in my direction. The car's grill looks like the grinning mouth of some metal monster. The car is pink, a sickly pink. The kind of pink found in vomit. The car thunders by, and I see the face of Whipper at the wheel, and his grin is as evil and ferocious as the car's grill. The other two guys poke their heads out the window and laugh raucously as they go by. I reach out and touch my father's package in the basket, and I keep pedaling. There is nothing else to do but keep pedaling. I approach the curve and coast for a moment, anticipating rescue there. But there is nothing. Only open fields. Why do the ecologists think we are running out of space on this planet? I've seen so many unoccupied and uninhabited places today that I'm starting to feel lonesome for stores and houses and sidewalks and traffic jams. But now there is a panic in the loneliness. I know the car will come back. The motor ignites the air again. I hear it coming. The sound of the motor is louder now, as if magnified, as if the road is a tunnel with invisible walls, and the thunder of the motor reverberates against those walls, increasing the decibels. I keep myself rigid, crouched on the bike, and the car comes closer, closer. This time the car brushes me. I feel the wind like a monster's foul breath, and I feel the contact of metal and a whine as the metal strikes my bike. The bike is wobbling dangerously, and I hang on. I fight to regain my balance. My shoulder bursts with pain, and I realize that something has struck my shoulder. One of the guys in the car tried to hit me as the car went by. Now it's gone again. But it will come back. I know it will come back. God, I say, and the word fills the emptiness left by the car, fractures the silence of the country air. I should have taken my pills this morning. I think of my options. I can leave the road and hide in the fields, but the fields present no hiding place. There are only a scattering of trees, and I would be spotted right away. I would also have to abandon the bike. And I can't stay here either. The car will mow me down. I can only keep on riding. Riding, hoping the car will come along that I can flag down. Or maybe the wise guys are tired of the game. Maybe they won't come back after all. Maybe they realize what they're doing, and it's against the law. Assault with a dangerous weapon. They have turned the car into a weapon. I hear the car coming again, not toward me as I expected. The motor whines from behind me. I hang on. I pedal furiously to maintain balance. I gather speed and momentum. My legs hurt, and my arms hurt, and my body hurts, but I keep pedaling, hurried by the sound of the motor like a wind blowing me along. I hear the squeal of the car's tires and the whine of the motor, and it's coming, coming, louder and louder, powerful and undeniable, and I brace myself. The car brushes by, and hands reach out for me, pushing, grabbing, and I lose my balance. The bike wavers under me and heads for the ditch, the steep ravine by the side of the road, and I am helpless to halt its progress toward the ditch. And the wheels spin, and I hear raucous laughter as I loom at the edge of the ditch, and then feel myself falling, spinning, sucked into the ditch, sucked into the wetness and darkness of a sudden, startling nighttime.
Tape OZK009-0900, date deleted, TA. Are you feeling better? They say you refused to get out of bed yesterday. Are you better today? 10-second interval. They say you've not eaten, that you've not slept, that you lie there staring into space. 5-second interval. But we know that you're not merely lying there staring into space, don't we? You're thinking, aren't you? Remembering? 15-second interval. And much of what you're remembering is unpleasant, isn't it? Terrible. But I'm here to help you make it not so terrible. 10-second interval. You must allow me to help you to get through this. You must not withdraw. 10-second interval. You must stay with us. You must not retreat. 5-second interval. You must face the gray man. Otherwise, everything will come to a halt. 10-second interval. We shall try it later. Please, take the medicine. Food, at least. I'm here always to help you. Remember that. and tape OZK-009. Tape OZK-010-0900, date deleted, TA. And how are we this morning? Forgive my cheerfulness, but it's a beautiful day outside. The birds are singing. It's quite a beautiful day. 10-second interval. You look alert this morning. Eyes bright. Flesh tones normal. How do you feel? 10-second interval. They tell me you've eaten. Breakfast, at least. That's good. You must keep up your strength. 10-second interval. Do you wish to converse? We can speak about anything you wish. I leave it up to you. 5-second interval. There's no need to discuss the gray man unless you wish to. We can talk about anything at all. Anything. 5-second interval. Very well. We can suspend. There may come a time when you wish to speak to me and I may not be here. 10-second interval. Let us suspend then. 10-second interval. Suspend. End tape OZK-010.
You all right, son?
I hear the voice and see the face at the same time as I rise from the spiraling darkness where there was nothing to hold on to, and I wanted to scream with panic but could not, and now suddenly, you all right, son? And the panic is over, and the face above me is kind and concerned, an old face, a grandfather kind of face. I'm all right, I say, struggling up. I don't like to be flat on my back. I always sleep on my stomach. And I don't like to be confined or held down. My instinct then is to get up on my feet, flailing my arms at anything that might try to hold me down, confine me. Take it easy, son, the man says, still gentle, still kind. I nod my head, stalling, trying to establish myself in the world again. My arms ache and my mouth tastes metallic, dirt and acid mixed together. You must have had quite a tumble, the man says. I stand erect, and the world settles down around me, and I remember what happened. The troublemakers, and the car, and the plunge into the ditch. Is the bike all right? I ask. Seems okay, the man says. We are standing by the side of the road. The man's car, a big station wagon with paneling, is parked nearby. A white-haired woman sits in the car, a worried expression on her face.
Is he all right, Arnold?
She calls.
Yes, he is, Edna, he answers.
Then to me,
sure you're okay? Boy, I was coming along slow. The wife doesn't like to go fast since she had a stroke. And I saw one of the wheels of your bike sticking up out of that ditch. And we stopped, and I came over to look, although the wife says people should mind their own business. You were lying in the ditch like you was fast asleep. I pulled your bike all the way up, and then your eyes flooded, and you came to.
I nod, thinking of the wise guys. I look around, wondering if they might return. I wonder how long I've been unconscious in the ditch. What time is it? I ask. My head aches.
Coming up to 4 o'clock,
the man says, his voice a Yankee twang, like a violin string being tuned. Thanks for stopping, I say. I appreciate it. I guess I lost my balance on the bike and fell into the ditch.
No broken bones?
He asks. I flex my arms and pat my chest and thighs. No broken bones, I say.
You from around here?
He asks.
We're gonna be late, Arnold,
his wife calls.
1 minute, dear,
he says, raising his voice, and again to me.
Can we give you a lift, son? We're going up to Hooksett. You look kinda tired.
Hooksett, that's right next to Belton Falls, isn't it?
Only a mile or two.
I know that I have been determined to cover the distance by bike,
but it's almost 4 o'clock, and I'll never make Belton Falls before darkness at this rate.
Listen, we can throw your bike in the back of the wagon. And don't mind my lady. She hasn't been herself since the stroke. Got no patience, poor thing. But she's a fine lady.
I realize that the important thing is to reach Rutterburg as soon as possible, and not the manner of traveling.
Well, if you don't think your wife will mind, I say,
you come with us. How far did you say you're going?
I'm going to Rutterburg, Vermont, but I'll be satisfied to make Belton Falls tonight. There's a motel there I can stay at, and then arrive fresh in Rutterburg tomorrow morning.
Well, you come along, he says. We can take you as far as Hooksett. Belton Falls is just next door.
I'd take you all the way, but my lady has an appointment at the doctor's.
I push the bike toward the car, and my legs resist movement. They echo with pain. My arms throbbing, my calves pulsing. I am a sheet of pain, but the car awaits, and I can rest and let my body renew itself.
Don't mind my lady, the man says. She's not herself these days.
I climb into the back seat of the car after putting the bike into the back of the station wagon. The woman darts a quick look at me and sniffs, her face pinched, her nose wrinkled. The smell of liniment fills the air. Not locker room liniment, but sick room liniment.
I'm not very comfortable with strangers in my car, Ronald, she says.
And the man shakes his head and murmurs,
Now, Edna, poor boy's had a fall and needs a ride, that's all.
The car bumps along, slow, about 20 miles an hour, and speeds up a bit once going up a hill, and the woman says,
Not too fast, Ronald, not too fast.
I close my eyes and let the minutes pass, let myself coast, let my body relax. I begin to feel nauseous. I have never been carsick in my life, but now my stomach bounces with the movement of the car, and I'm afraid I will have to vomit. I look out the window at the passing scene. We are entering a town. Fleming, probably. That's my next stop, and I think that maybe I should get out in Fleming and get some Alka-Seltzer in a drugstore. But I think of pedaling all the way from Fleming to Hooksett, and I tell myself, hold on, hold on. I begin to sing to myself, silently, so that the man and woman won't hear me. The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell, hi-ho the merry-o, the farmer in the dell. I sing, and I think of the motel waiting in Belton Falls, and how a good night's sleep will soothe my body and restore my energy, and how tomorrow I will see my father in Rutterburg. The wife takes the child, the wife takes the child, hi-ho the merry-o, the wife takes the child. It's pleasant now, drifting and singing, my stomach not churning anymore, and the car purring smoothly, and then I hear the man say,
Well, we're here, son.
I must have fallen off to sleep, because we're on a busy street, traffic heavy, neon signs pulsing in the gathering dusk.
Is this Hooksett?
I ask, surprised at the quick passage of time.
Do you think we'd lie?
The woman asks, sniffing again.
Now, Edna, the man says.
He stops the car and I get ready to leave. I gather my package and the road map. My stomach is nauseous again, but I figure I will go into the first drugstore I see and order an Alka-Seltzer. I open the door, and the sounds of the city grow in my ears, as if someone has turned on the volume. The man gets out of the car to help me with the bike and says,
I hope you get there all right, boy. You look kinda green around the gills there. Better get some rest before moving on.
Thank you, I say. I appreciate it very much. He pats me on the shoulder and goes back to the car, and I look around for a drugstore. Despite my stomach, I am glad to be in Hooksett, because it is only a short distance now to Rutterburg, Vermont.
Tape OZK 011-0915, date deleted TA.
My arm hurts. My body hurts, all those needles.
I am sorry. I shall ask them to shift the area of penetration. You realize it was necessary, don't you? You retreated completely. We had to take drastic measures.
I know.
You do understand, then.
I don't understand anything, really. Why I'm here, how I got here.
That's what we're attempting to learn. That's why we're going through all this. 8-second interval. It's possible that you went into retreat because you were getting close to remembering. And there will be pain in the remembering. You realize that, don't you? It's possible that the gray man represents the key, and at the last moment, you refuse to use the key, afraid of what would be lurking beyond the door the key would open. 5-second interval.
I know who the gray man is now. I think I know everything.
Everything?
I think so.
Then tell me. Get it out. Begin anywhere, but tell it. Expel it. Who was this gray man?
He was part of our lives, and yet not part of it. He was always there, someone I took for granted. Let me explain it this way. My father told me about a mystery story a long time ago. It was called The Invisible Man. Not the invisible man they made a movie out of, but another one. It was a murder story, I guess. Anyway, the cops were all watching the street, waiting for the killer to arrive, to strike. And the killer did arrive, but nobody saw him. Later on, they discovered that the killer was the mailman. He had calmly walked down the street, and no one had noticed him because he was like part of the scenery. He was so commonplace that he was invisible. That's the way the gray man was in our lives.
How often did he enter your life?
He came to our house once or twice a month. All those years. Usually on the weekend, Saturdays mostly. He'd ring the bell, and immediately my mother would go up to her room, and my father and the gray man would go down to the cellar.
The cellar?
I thought I'd told you. There was a room down there that my father had paneled, finished off as a sort of recreation room and office. He and the gray man would go down there for about an hour, maybe. I never went down there with them. Then the man would leave.
And why did you call him the Gray Man?
That's the funny part. His name was Gray. At least my father called him that. But he also seemed like a gray man to me.
And why was that? Was he addicted to gray clothes?
Not really. But there was something gray about him. His hair was gray. But more than that, to me, gray is a nothing color. And that's how Mr. Gray seemed to me. Like nothing.
So he came to your house all those years, and you were never curious about him or suspicious?
Well, there was nothing to be suspicious about. My father had told me Mr. Gray was the supervisor of the New England branch of the insurance company that employed him. He said they had to draw up confidential reports and such. And I accepted the explanation, of course. I had no reason to doubt my father back then. I mean, Mr. Gray had been a presence in our lives, part of the scenery, part of the house, like the furniture. There was nothing to be suspicious about until I became suspicious of everything.
And when did you become suspicious of everything?
After that phone call, when I overheard my mother talking to that woman who was my aunt, a secret aunt. I could overlook the two birth certificates. That could have been some kind of mistake, but not this woman. She was real.
Why didn't you confront your parents about the woman? 6-second interval.
Because I was in a panic, trying to pretend it never happened, that I hadn't heard the telephone call. I also knew that I would have to confess how I'd spied on my mother, listened in on her conversation. I kept telling myself that there had to be a logical explanation. I knew they loved me, and I had to trust their love, believe in them. So I was in a panic, and I felt guilty, and I found it hard to look either my mother or my father in the face. And then that particular Saturday arrived.
Tell me.
He had been waiting for a telephone call from Amy Hertz. The night before, she had told him that she was planning a number at St. Jude's Church the following day, something to do with a wedding. Adam had been appalled at the prospect, losing the cool he always tried to display to Amy.
"Listen, Amy, you're not going to desecrate a church, are you? Or invade somebody's wedding?" he asked. Of course not, dear Ace. Merely a little diversion. And don't worry, the church itself isn't involved. The parking lot. That's our area of concentration.
She refused to explain further.
I'll call you in the morning. The wedding isn't until 2 p.m. Thus, he was hanging around the house, both hoping for and dreading Amy's call, when Mr. Gray rang the doorbell. Adam opened the front door. Mr. Gray looked as grim and bleak and as gray as usual. He seldom wasted time with polite greetings, murmuring, "My boy," to Adam, and entering the house briskly, as if being chased by the wind. Adam heard the bedroom door being closed by his mother upstairs. His father came forward from the back of the house. Years ago, Mr. Gray brought Adam occasional gifts, toy boats, bats, balls. Now he barely glanced at Adam. Adam stepped aside. Mr. Gray and his father headed as usual for the cellar stairs. Adam watched them, curious about Mr. Gray for the first time. If he had an aunt somewhere out there hidden from him, could Mr. Gray be an uncle? He dismissed the thought as absurd. Restless, bored, he prowled the rooms, waiting for Amy's call. He realized that more and more he had become dependent on Amy to fill his hours, to fill his life. Adam's shyness had always prevented him from making easy friendships. He wasn't capable of intimacy with others. He didn't dare confess his hopes and desires to others, his longing to be a famous writer. He thought people would either laugh or scoff. Strangely enough, Amy Hertz, whose goal in life seemed to be only laughter and mischief, had turned out to be the person with whom he was comfortable, with whom he could share his dreams. He kept few secrets from her. And he wondered sometimes if he should tell her about all his doubts, the birth certificates, and now the secret aunt. He was afraid, of course, that she'd tell him he was losing his mind. He thought of Mr. Gray in the recreation room below. What a square. A stuffed shirt, he thought. He considered what a target Mr. Gray would make for one of Amy's numbers. Amy had driven Mr. Crandall, a hated teacher, up the wall a few weeks ago by sending him anonymous love letters, passionate letters obviously from a student. The Amy Hertz touch? Giving the letters a definite masculine tone, so that poor Mr. Crandall thought he was being pursued by a passionate teenage homosexual. I, too, am capable of mischief, Adam thought, and he went to the cellar door. He listened. Nothing. He opened the door and went down the stairs. The door to the recreation room was closed. Adam walked stealthily toward the door, almost on tiptoe. He placed his ear against it, listening shamelessly. Nothing. Place must be soundproof, he thought. It struck him then that the recreation room was almost like a vault. He had always felt mildly claustrophobic in the room. His father had sealed off the cellar windows, completely paneling the walls and ceilings. "When I want privacy, I get privacy," he had joked. But had he really been joking? Adam's ear was warm against the wood of the door. At that moment, he heard the knob turn. Adam swiveled around and withdrew into the shadows. His father emerged in silhouette. Adam flattened himself against the wall. Had his father seen him? Had he heard him outside the door? His father paused now, said something to Mr. Gray that Adam was too flustered to hear, his heart beating loudly in his body, and crossed the cellar. He went up the steps. Adam heard him proceed through the rooms upstairs, his steps echoing in the ceiling. There was no sound from Mr. Gray in the recreation room. Adam was afraid that the thud of his heart could be heard, like the heart in that Edgar Allan Poe story. His father came back down the stairs. He didn't look in Adam's direction. He didn't seem upset or rushed. He closed the door, shutting out the ray of light. And Adam allowed himself to relax, to sag against the wall. He was drenched with perspiration.
He made his way slowly and quietly up the stairs.
Is that all?
No.
Take your time now. I see you're perspiring. There are Kleenexes there. Help yourself.
Thank you.
10-second interval. And had your father seen you at the door downstairs?
Yes. But I didn't know that right away. I suspected that he...